Welcome back. So today on the show, as I said earlier, we're listening to an interview I recorded earlier this week with John Nichols and Robert McChesney about their book, Dollarocracy, how the money and media election complex is destroying America. We recorded it at 2640 in Baltimore this past Tuesday at an event organized by Red Emmas. We recorded it in partnership with the Real News Network, and soon they'll be posting their video at realnews.com. Welcome, everybody. Good to have you with us tonight, and this is a good time to do it, given that this is the anniversary of the day that Harriet Tubman fled to freedom. This is the anniversary of Occupy, Wall Street, that happened. This is the anniversary of when the U.S. Constitution was actually signed.
Absolutely.
And all these kinds of things fit into where we are tonight here, and I welcome you all and let you know that we are taping this for radio and taping it for to put up on the Nation magazine video and taping it for Real News. So all of this is happening all at once. So have your say, and it'll be heard other places besides the church. This is the second time I've interviewed these two men, John Nichols and Bob McChesney, for their book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. And you all know these men, but if you don't, let me tell you. John is the Madison, Wisconsin-based Washington editor for The Nation magazine.
That's right.
He thinks that the only way you can really cover Washington is from the outside in, which is probably not a bad idea. And and he has been in media for a long time. He's wrote for The Progressive in these times. He's still associated with the Capital Times, which is a really good newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. Written numerous books, along with Bob McChesney, who has as well, who's the, see if I say this right, Bob, the Goodsell Endowed Professor in the
That's
Department of Communications,
good.
Is that right?
Good, yeah.
At the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, author of many books. Two of these men co-founded Free Press, and in 2008, McChesney was named one of the 50 visionaries who are changing the world. And they put this book together among all the other books they're writing, and have joined us here on part of their national tour. And so, gentlemen, welcome to Baltimore.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Good to have you all here.
Thank you.
So we're going to do this conversation up here for a little bit, and then we'll open it up to folks to join the conversation and ask questions and have some comments as well. But let me begin with this. Let me begin with this quote that's in the book from Martin Luther King, which I think is an important quote to kind of get a sense of the book. So long as I do not firmly and irrevocably possess the right to vote, I do not possess myself. I cannot make up my mind. It is made up for me. I cannot live as a democratic citizen, observing the laws I have helped to enact. I can only submit to the edict of others. And that being said, in the middle of the struggle to gain the right to vote, but now we have to say this in the middle of the struggle to keep our vote. How times change in barely 60-odd years.
And, you know, the next quote is also interesting, too, right after that.
Oh, Benjamin Franklin.
Read the Franklin quote.
Do that, too. That's right below. I'll have that underlined. They who have no voice nor vote in the electing of representatives do not enjoy liberty, but are absolutely enslaved to those who have votes.
I mean, the right to vote has, you know, been a central struggle in all democratic societies, and it's been a struggle between, especially in unequal societies. I couldn't get it to stay. See, this is recalcitrant.
We're good.
And, you know, in societies that are unequal and egalitarian, the few who own most of the property are always threatened on election day by the great many who don't have property for fear that they will not vote. They will not appreciate the justice of the current system that rewards those at the top. And there's been a struggle there for about who can vote. It's been right as part of the American experience. It's the great democratic struggles have always been about expanding the franchise. And to this country's great credit, from an ignominious beginning, through a number of wonderful struggles, we got to the point by the 1970s where we had more or less universal adult suffrage for people over the age of 18, which it took us a couple hundred years to get there, but we got there. And I think what we argue in Dollarocracy is that those atop the system now, since the 1970s, have been doing everything in their power to undermine the democratic gains that have been won, to undermine the most democratic aspects of our society, and put us on a path to a much more inegalitarian, undemocratic society. And in the book, we talk about the two key ways that's done. One is by unleashing the power of money so it's easier to buy elections. It's a dollarocracy, $1, one vote, and not one person, one vote. And the other side of the coin is what you were referring to, Mark, in your question, which is we see what can only be called obscene in the last 4 years, an effort to make it difficult for people to vote, if not impossible, to remove the franchise overwhelmingly from people who are not seen as being sufficiently appreciative of rich people, to be honest. That's what it's about.
Right.
People who will not vote the right way. So since you can't buy their vote or you can't suppress their vote, you just simply make it impossible to vote through a variety of mechanisms, which in southern states would have been illegal until the Supreme Court acted a couple months ago. This is a key part of the whole process we talk about in the book, and I'm glad you're highlighting it. It is one of the great struggles going forward for all of us.
And one of the things that some people look at this, John, as a kind of a real contradiction about where America is going and a great fear. I mean, some people could posit that, you know, there was this explosion in the 50s and 60s that created the final levels of the right to vote in the United States of America. Mm-hmm. And the fear of folks who are in power to see that surge is part of the backlash we have now, because now people feel almost helpless and hopeless looking at what we've come to in terms of Voting Rights Act and what's happened to Right to Vote and Citizens United and the rest.
But if there's any point to the book, it is that you should not be helpless and hopeless. And we'll get to that as we evolve here. I'm not going to go into the whole rap there because it's a nice place to lead to. However, it's an important thing to understand. The American experiment was founded in original sin. I mean, we are in a church, and it is appropriate to say that. There's something fundamentally wrong about a country that begins in revolution against monarchical power, against empire, against colonialism, and then decides that structurally it will enslave a substantial portion of its population and allow that slavery, but used through the three-fifths rule, accounting of those slaves to make sure that you can distribute, you know, wealth and the benefits of government, you know, around. And so this was a really troublesome reality at the founding of the American experiment, one that we should not think to ourselves was done simply by mistake. The fact of the matter is there were people at the founding of the Republic, people like Tom Paine, who said slavery's wrong. And so it's not like, oh, we didn't know slavery was wrong. They knew it was wrong. Many of the people who did it knew it was wrong. The people who actually allowed it, Jefferson was clear. And there's no doubt that Jefferson knew slavery was wrong. And yet he allowed it. In fact, he practiced it. And so what did they do? And, you know, sometimes we see this in movies. We don't see it. We don't think of it in our day-to-day political life. But, in fact, movies do this really well, where, you know, it's a terrible, dramatic situation. People are in a horrible circumstance. And somebody puts, you know, like a little failsafe or a little protection in there. And they say, you know, we know it's bad now, but if you find this, you might be able to fix the thing. And the incredible thing is that the founders put in the failsafe of being able to amend the Constitution of the United States. Because the founding Constitution of this country was not a small D democratic constitution. This was a document that was written so that a people in a room about this size would choose a member of Congress. That was what happened. The founding of the American experiment, about 6% of people could vote, roughly 6% of the population. And they would gather. They didn't do ballot boxes. They would gather in a room like this, and they would debate which of us white guys, white wealthy guys, are we going to send to Congress? And that was the game. And the incredible thing about the founding of the American experiment was when they had these votes, they would have them in a room. They didn't have air conditioning, so they would open the windows. And who was outside looking in? It was a spectator sport. Politics, much like today, was a spectator sport. And so people would come and look in the window. The black people were there looking in the window. The Native Americans, and many, remember, in those early days, Native Americans had not been forced off their land and forced west. And so many of them are looking in the window. The women are looking in the window because no women could vote. Any white working person, because you didn't know land, you couldn't vote, was looking in the window. And so the great mass, 94% of the population is looking in while 6% decides what happens. Constitutional amendments, and it's a long road through, man. Most of if you look at our constitutional amendments, they're overwhelmingly about the right to vote and the right to participate. It's an astounding thing. We don't tell our history that way. But the fact of the matter is that after the Civil War, what did we do? We extended the right to vote to African-American men. And then, or relatively slowly, we extended it to women. And then, amazingly enough, we extended it to Native Americans because we decided eventually it was their country, we'd let them vote too. And but it didn't stop there. It was not until 1962, and this is a big deal. It wasn't until 1962, with the barring, by a constitutional amendment, the barring of the poll tax, that we said that that wealth could not be a barrier to voting, that your economic circumstance. It was only 1962 that we did that, and it wasn't until 1970 that we said people who we send to die in wars could actually vote on whether to go to war. It's an incredible evolution. That little failsafe they put in kind of worked. But when it worked enough, the 6%, perhaps only 1%, but what, you know, those people that were in the room, the white guys, right? They decided, okay, we've had enough of this. And it's a fascinating thing. The last major step when we extended the right to vote to 18 to 21-year-olds came early 1970s, and we won't go into all the detail on this because we'll talk about it as we go along. Early 1970s, the Powell memo, Lewis Powell, wrote a memo that this democracy thing is getting out of control. They are starting to regulate corporations. They're starting to actually take cigarette ads off TV. What next? And you saw the construction of a pushback. And there is no other way to say this, than it is this is the reassertion of the 6%. It's the reassertion of those people that were in the room. Now, they may not all be white guys now. There might even be some white women. There might even be some people of color who have decided to opt for this. But the bottom line is this is a very small circle of people with a lot of wealth who have decided that they want a structure where their money allows them, just as it was in 1798, to be in that room with everybody else looking in. And this is the great struggle of our time. And just as we had those fail-safes in our Constitution 225 years ago that slowly allowed us to evolve and make it better, we need to recognize that we need a bunch of new amendments. We shouldn't be casual about it. We need to add to our Constitution to ensure the right to vote and the right to have a politics that is reflective of our votes rather than destructive of them.
So there's so much here, and I'm going to just kind of combine some questions we did the last time, just in interest of time, and kind of get some things out here, because we talk about the over 75% of Americans who voted, as you say in the book, after the Civil War, and plummeted to where we are now, 58%, sometimes lower than that.
Usually lower than that. 58% actually was the high water mark of the last 40 years.
And you look at local elections, whether they're here or Detroit or someplace else, you're lucky if it's 10 or 12%,
that's right.
10 or 13%. So tie that in for us historically about what the process was between that and also making the connection between why that vote is going down so low and what happened with the idea of the building of the free press in America and its diminution.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's a big...
Good, but he actually went right there, didn't he?
Yeah. Well, actually, let me start with talking a little about voter turnout, because this isn't talked about a lot. You know, the United States voter turnout in the 20th century, really, since the progressive era going forward, with a blip in the 30s and early 40s, has been well below what it was in the 19th century, second half of the 19th century in particular, among eligible voters, and well below what other democratic nations have. And this was something that's always been sort of astounding to political scientists. Why does the United States vote so much lower than everyone else? And, you know, our voter turnout rate in 2012 was 52% of people over 18 voted. And, you know, probably in 2014 in the off-year election, it will be 35 or 6%. And as you said, once you get off those November elections in even-numbered years, you go to all those other elections, you're down in the 10 to 25% range oftentimes. It's really quite extraordinary. The other point that's striking, though, is that voting in the United States is class skewed. It's wonderful to hear these expert commenters like, well, African Americans are voting like crazy now. Boy, what's going on with these African Americans? They vote so much after the last election. Well, actually, the data shows pretty strongly that if you really want an indicator for who votes and who doesn't vote, the best, most reliable way is by income level. People in the top 15% of the population vote at more than twice the rate of people in the bottom 15%. And it's a direct line from the top group to the bottom. So that the median income for the average voter is in the 60% area, not 50%. So much more affluent people vote, far fewer people vote. And that means we get a politics that is skewed quite radically different than sort of the broad population. That's part of our American heritage we're wrestling with in the book. And I will say one other thing. I'll let John handle the press part, because I just want to add one other point. In a way, if you read our book and if you think about it, it's really surprising that many people actually vote. I mean, it's a testament, I think, to Americans' deep civic virtue that 52% of them actually vote. When you look at what the ballot looks like, it's not just the matter, and I suspect this is an audience that appreciates the lack of choice oftentimes between the two dominant parties. That's part of it, obviously. I mean, the range of debate is so small, whoever wins, it doesn't seem like it really matters much. But there's also the matter that so many of the races now are what's called gerrymandered. Mm-hmm. So the decision's been made before you go in the voting booth. You automatically know who's won most of the races on the ballot. The Economist magazine had a great line. They say, in most democracies, voters select their representatives. In America, representatives select their voters. Mm-hmm. And so... And, you know, in a state like Wisconsin, where John and I live, there are 8 House seats in the U.S. House of Representatives, and Wisconsin's pretty much a 50-50 state. So theoretically, you could have 8 seats that are hotly contested, even in the two-party system, and so as a voter, you'd have some stake in voting. But they gerrymandered it between the two parties, so there are 4 safe seats for the Republicans, 4 safe seats for the Democrats, or something like that. So I know in my district, if I don't vote, it will have no effect on who's going to win my House race. It's locked in for the Democrat. It's a Democratic area. So viewed that way, between the money, the two-party system, and gerrymandering, you know, it's not an irrational to say maybe voting is a much of a difference, and that 52% of Americans do is, I think, a statement that they really want a democracy.
To John, tied into what happened to the media in that same period.
What? Tell me what year you're starting.
We're talking about the press in the 19th century, okay. How it became the press of the 20th century, and how it became diminished.
I don't know if you people know what a treasure you have in Mark Steiner, because the fact of the matter is that you have to ask him what century he's starting in. Most of the people in media in America don't know there was a century other than the 21st. But look, here's the bottom line of the American experiment is this, and it is the bottom line. This is not a political or an economic reality. This is a physical reality. It's a physical reality. If you don't feed someone, they die. If you do not feed people information, they cannot be their own governors. They cannot rule themselves, they become spectators. And this was an understanding that was alive at the beginning of the American experiment. And that freedom of the press protection, they fully understood that it would be bogus if you just said there's free press without a press, right? You'd say, oh, yeah, you have this, and you also have the right to jump over this church if you can, right? Well, no, free press had to be real. And this was an important concept at the founding of the Republic, and what they did at the founding of the Republic was say, well, we don't have advertising agencies and PR firms and stuff like that, and Rupert Murdoch hasn't been born yet. He'll be born several years from now, but not. And so we need to make sure this thing works. And so what did they do at the founding of the American experiment? Not because they liked the press. Jefferson, Madison, these guys hated the press. They despised it. Even Jefferson said he didn't read a newspaper after he was president. But they knew that people had to have the information. And so they massively subsidized a free press. So that everybody, any person of any competence who started a newspaper could deliver that newspaper for free.
Close to free.
You're right. Well, then remember there's a debate. The debate was whether it was free or you charged less than any other mail. Right, and the conservatives were you had to charge a little bit. The progressives said no, absolutely free because you couldn't put any charge on it. And then they actually had debates in Congress about whether you'd take a piece of paper and print one side of an argument on the other, and the other side, you know, so yeah, both sides would send it to everybody so that they could see what the debate was. It's an incredible moment, and they actually provide direct subsidies to some publications because they said, well, somebody's got to cover government. You know, and they'd subsidize a pro-government publication, an anti-government one. This was America. This is not Sweden, although they do it in Sweden, too. And so we really believed that you needed a free press to make democracy work. And we invested a lot in it, a huge portion of our budget at the founding of this country. And you know what the most incredible thing was? We didn't have state-run media. We proved in America that you can have a democracy-sustaining and a democracy-expanding media that is content-neutral. Some of the first African-American-owned businesses in the United States that got federal money, or I should say they got the postal subsidy, they got federal aid, in effect, were abolitionist newspapers. Now, we're in a country that allowed slavery, and yet the structures of the country allowed the revolt against slavery to develop. And the great struggles of the abolitionist newspapers of 150 years ago, 170 years ago, was about the postal subsidy to maintain it and make sure that we could get the information out. Every county seat in the North had an abolitionist publication. That's how that movement was built. And it was built on people believing that you had to have that. Well, I'm not going to go through the whole story, but just say that for a brief period, advertising came along, and people said, well, advertising can sustain us. You know, it would sustain. And it actually did. A city like Baltimore had 10 newspapers. 100 years ago? Oh, New York City had 24 daily newspapers. You know when New York City's first Arabic language newspaper was started? 1924. You know, the fact of the matter is, you had a radical diversity of information, and coming from all sorts of different perspectives. And this is something you still see in Europe because they still subsidize the press. But we had consolidation, and still to get all that ad money. But with the internet, and this is not to get complicated here, but the money went away. Money found other ways to get to you. It comes through your phone now, right? So the fact is that our media, our structural media, the old school, is dying. The subsidies aren't there. We don't subsidize public or any kind of sufficiently. The subsidies aren't there. The structural supports aren't there. The advertising isn't there. So you don't have a Baltimore Evening Sun anymore, and you have a Baltimore Sun in the morning that looks like the shred that you used to throw away from the old paper. It's nothing. It's gone as an entity in the sense. And they still lie to you. They say, well, you know, 20 years ago we needed 300 people to cover this community. Now we can do it with 50. Right, or 100. Well, that's a lie. They can't. Right. They're just giving you less and charging you more. And so this is bringing around full circle. We're back at the point of the founding. We keep telling people in this tour, you have to be founders again. You have to, you know, say, okay, how do we make this thing work? You can't have democracy if people don't have a free flow of information and a lot of ideas coming from a lot of different perspectives. And you cannot make them college professors. You cannot say, you must spend your day, get up early, and research and go on the internet and go to the library. No, it's supposed to be popular information easily available to working class people so they can get a good set of ideas and information from a lot of different perspectives without having to, you know, literally spend hours and days digging it out. Because a lot of working people don't have the time to do that. And we have created a structure now. We talk about voter suppression. You know what the ultimate voter suppression is? Our media. And it's not that people try, there may be negative players in it, but think about this. A media that gives you 7-8 minutes of sports on the evening news, gives you 8-9 minutes of weather on the evening news, then gives you exercise tips on the evening news, but doesn't cover your school board. Right? That ultimately tells you what's important. And what's important is not you running the democratic life of your community, it is all this other stuff. And where's our media outlets get their money now increasingly? From campaign ads. In some competitive markets, we're in very competitive states, swing states, as much as 20% of the revenues for television stations comes from campaign ads. So understand what we've done. Close with what I'll say here. We have dialed down the independent, free content coming from dissident views, all this discourse. We don't have 24 papers anymore. We barely have one. Our radio's laid off, everything. We've dialed all that down, and we've dialed the money up. Understand that concept, right? Who tells you about politics today? Who tells you about governance? Who tells the average person, gives them their information? The rich, because the rich pay for the ads. And so we live in a state where this free discourse, this open discourse, has been replaced by what the Norwegians, who ban campaign ads, refer to as propaganda. because they don't allow campaign ads. Why? Because they said it's an important thing, and election's a big deal. You have to have real information and good ideas. If all you got was parties telling you or candidates telling you to vote for them, that's not functional, because they might lie.
Really?
I'm serious.
Look, you got to be kidding.
I've heard this.
Okay, fine. That was John Nichols. You also heard Robert McChesney. They're the authors of the book Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. We'll be right back to hear more of our conversation with Bob McChesney and John Nichols. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and today on the show, we're listening to an interview I recorded with John Nichols and Robert McChesney about their book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We recorded it at 2640 in Baltimore last Tuesday at an event organized by Red Emmons. So you have, in the beginning of the book, you have this one page. You talk a little bit about Glass-Steagall, just for a second in the book. So when I was rereading some of the notes I did from the last time that we spoke, I was thinking about this direct correlation between the destruction of Glass-Steagall and allowing banks and corporations to do as they will. There's a lineage between that and Citizens United, which you do spend a lot of time talking about in the book, and what has the force of taking away the right to vote in America that have controlled about the corporate greed kind of running everything and have stopped it. So can we make that connection for a moment?
Sure.
I mean, I think that's something. I think there's a real joint here that we don't put together.
Well, I think, and this gets to the solution that we need a cumulative solution that goes after a lot of things in
right.
the Democratic cocktail,
right.
because we have to understand that what we're battling against here, and John referred to this earlier, is a corporate movement, a movement by those at the top, by the 6%, the 1%, those who own a lot. To really roll back the great Democratic victories. And we had some great victories in this country in the first 70 years of the 20th century and minimized the threat of democracy. John talked about the Lewis Powell memo from 1971 for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is really an extraordinary statement and very important. We have
it's
a chapter,
in here.
We
have it's a really an important statement, a very critical statement.
And, you know, Lewis Powell was scared to death, as were a lot of people in American business, but how unpopular corporations were by the early 70s. Ralph Nader was the most popular public figure in American life at this time. There were a lot of people who thought this country was moving in a very different direction than its history, that it was not being sufficiently reverential towards business. There was a lot of concern that traditionally apathetic or unpolitical or apolitical parts of the population, like women, students, African Americans, were suddenly getting too involved in politics. The crisis of democracy was that there was too much democracy. And the response from the Powell memo, the Chamber of Commerce, was on many fronts. They wanted to do battle to whittle away at the idea that the government could serve popular interests and return to the idea that there was no hope to change anything, the government should basically work to serve private interests who dominate. And this manifests itself, the most important way immediately was through a huge increase in corporate lobbying. All the trade associations moved to Washington. They'd been based in, like, the auto workers were based in Detroit, the rubber trade association in Akron. They'd be based in the town where the production was based for a long time. Suddenly they all moved to Washington. There was a tenfold increase in lobbyists from the 70s to a decade later to what we have today. And they said, we've got to take over the government. We've got to run this darn thing. And this was the starting point. They also went out, these are the leading corporations of America, and they said, well, who's going to be our top lobbyists? Who are the people who are ideally suited to do this work to deal with regulators and politicians? And they had a great idea. Let's hire politicians to be our lobbyists. So in 1970, 3% of people who left Congress went on to become lobbyists. Today, the figure is well over 50%. We chronicle this in the book, and the salaries they make are huge increases. So if a member leaves the House of Representatives, he or she will get an income generally in the $400,000 to $600,000 range on K Street as a lobbyist. If you leave the Senate, that's when the ka-ching starts hitting. You're getting between $800,000 and $1.5 million as a K Street lobbyist. So being a representative of the people, doing public service in Congress now, is sort of graduate school. It's finishing school for the real payoff down the road. And I think this may be an unintended consequence of what they had in mind, but it's produced the effect. The politicians in both parties have internalized this. Hey, If I want that big payday, I've got to prove now I can play ball with them. If I want that $1.5 million job rather than the college job teaching four classes for $51,000, maybe I'm going to have to look kindly upon the interest of the people who are going to be writing the check for $1.5 million. And that was part of this program, too. It goes, there's a number of ways, but the reason for this, and this gets to Glass-Steagall, is that they desperately wanted to get rid of things like those New Deal reforms, which were meant basically to protect the people of this country from financial capitalism and rapacious capitalism. And Glass-Steagall was always something they had in the back of their mind that they wanted to get rid of. And one way to understand this, and this is something I suspect, Mark, you've had in your show, there was an extraordinary quote from President Eisenhower, Dwight Eisenhower, in 1954. He wrote a letter to, I think it was his brother Milton.
It was to Milton.
It was to Milton. And he said in the letter, he said, Milton, you know, and I think Milton Eisenhower was more liberal than Dwight, and was a little freaked out by some of the rawer elements of the Republican Party back then. That, and he said, Brother Dwight, you know, you've got these characters like the Hunt brothers out there in Texas who are just rabid right-wing fanatics. And so Eisenhower wrote his brother and said, you know, there are people like the Hunt brothers. There's a handful of these lunatics who don't believe, hate Social Security, they hate trade unions, they hate progressive taxation, they hate public education, they want to get rid of all four of those institutions. But that will never happen again in America. We're beyond that. As a society, those are now accepted tenets, and any politician has to accept those to get to elected office. Clear,
you've broken from Eisenhower now.
Pardon?
You've broken from Eisenhower. You're not reading Eisenhower's letter anymore.
No.
He said that could never happen.
No, but he actually mentioned those in the letter. Yeah. He mentioned those institutions. These are things that cannot...
They could never go back.
They could never go. Those are stuck in America. And if you look at what the Powell memo and what this corporate attack has been, it's about each of those four things, trying to get rid of them. And among those were Glass-Steagall, the regulations which prevented the banks from going off and speculating and going crazy and doing what we happened in the 1930s around the world, which was drive the economy over a cliff and destroy it through speculation.
And some of that's tied to the stuff you've written about a lot, which is the diminution of the press. Mm-hmm. Because if you unleash corporate money, how it can control and buy the press, which it did, mm-hmm. which has led to the place we're in now.
Mm-hmm. To a large extent. And Bob's a pioneer on this. I've been lucky to go along with him and talk about some of this. But, you know, we've had massive consolidation of our media. And, you know, it's often, we deal with it so often. You know, the heroic figure on this was Ben Bagdikian, the former Washington Post editor, who, you know, kind of, Ben is still around,
yes.
But he's like 3,000 years old now.
No, this is being recorded, John.
Yeah.
We're going to edit that out.
No, I won't, because Ben has the wisdom of those years. And I would simply say, it's amazing to me that Ben Bagdikian, at a point of retirement 30 years ago, said, you know, now I'm going to devote my time to talking about what's wrong in America. And he wrote about consolidation of media. And Bob, is it right that at that time it was 50 initially in the first?
Well, yeah, the classic, Ben Bagdikian wrote a book called The Media Monopoly.
And, it was 50.
And in 1983, the first volume, he chronicled the 50 firms that dominated the media. And it kept getting smaller and smaller when it did subsequent editions. And he finally, I think, got down to like eight or nine.
Six.
Or six.
I think six.
And then the last edition he called The New Media Monopoly, because he introduced the digital monopolist. There's new players in it that sort of changed the terrain, too.
But Bagdikian's accomplishment was epic, because it basically just said, look, you know, you get fewer and fewer owners. They're going to get bigger and bigger. They're going to – it's not going to be the publisher who, you know, has a house on the hill and, you know, maybe you see him driving through town in his nice car, but, you know, if you really don't like it, throw an egg at his car or something,
exactly.
You know.
Right.
At least – or maybe you stopped at the coffee shop and you could actually talk to him. No. The publisher of your newspaper is not going to live anywhere near your town. Neither is the owner of your TV station. Your media will become delinked from you, and instead of being organic of your place, it will speak from above to a national agenda. Now, this is the big deal as regards democracy, and I learned it working on a daily newspaper. I learned it in Toledo, Ohio. And I worked in Toledo, Ohio in the mid-'80s, early 90s, when NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, was proposed. And it was obvious to me that Toledo should be against NAFTA, right? Because Toledo is a factory town. And there's simply no doubt that NAFTA was going to not be good for industrial workers, for the industries they were. It could not possibly be because it created a race to the bottom. It's encouraged. And then China free trade, most favored nation trading status for China. This is not anti-Mexico or anti-China, because these aren't really free trade deals. These are, in fact, deals that are structurally created to make sure that corporations can jump from country to country looking for the lowest wages they can find, pitting workers against other workers. And so this is very obvious. And I thought, well, of course, Tito Blade will be opposed to this. And in fact, we did oppose it. And it was, you know, a wonderful thing. And then it happened the year that NAFTA was being debated, I moved to Madison, Wisconsin. Very liberal town, very progressive town. Became an editorial page editor there. And at Madison Capital Times opposed NAFTA. And I thought, wow, that's great. We're getting a lot of opposition to NAFTA here. It was only afterwards that we found out, when they did a survey, the unions actually did a survey, there were two newspapers that opposed NAFTA. It was Toledo and Madison. And you're sort of like, well, this isn't good. And there's actually one newspaper in South Carolina that opposed it, sort of for like sovereignty things that had a lot to do with Ron Paul. But the fact of the matter is 1,700 newspapers, most of them in towns with factories, towns like Baltimore, which has had severe deindustrialization. They said, oh, this is a great idea. Let's do free trade. Well, that's what happens with consolidated ownership. It's not the only thing. There's a million other things we could talk about. But this is a fundamental thing for democracy. Your media is delinked from your community. It's not in touch with your community. And it legitimizes ideas that could never live in your community in a rational moment. And what we suggest now is, and Bob and I write about this some in the book and talk about it, is we have this notion called zombie ideas. And these are ideas that, by any rational standpoint, are dead and buried. They could not possibly walk among us. Like getting rid of Social Security. No one's for that. Nobody in their right mind. You're undermining Medicare, Medicaid. Taking away the right to organize a trade union. I mean, no! When we invade countries, right? When we invade countries and help them write their constitution, we write in protections for trade unions, right? And so how could these ideas even be, you know, how could they walk among us? Well, part of it is a media that is so delinked from its place and just feeds an agenda that happens to be very, very beneficial to very, very rich people. And when you have a handful of companies control your media, the people who run those companies are very, very rich people. It's not a conspiracy. They're doing what makes sense. But unfortunately, what makes sense to them doesn't make a lot of sense to the communities where our media exists. And we end up with a disastrous situation that is dysfunctional, frankly.
So let's, before we open everybody jump into this conversation with us, and we'll put the mic over there so y'all can get in it. I'm going to kind of bring some things from the book here to kind of get it out there. One is, hello? One is to talk about the $10 billion number and dark money. Because you always hear $6 billion. Your book posits $10 billion, not six.
Yep.
What I'm talking about is money spent in the last election, the most expensive election, and why it's 10 and not six, and what is this dark money?
I'll start with that.
I'm going to answer the question. Bob's going to answer the question. I'm going to just extrapolate why it matters between 6 and 10, right? Because the thing in media is that last year cost about $6 billion. And if you buy $6 billion, then, you know, Citizens United didn't change that much.
Right.
That, you know, $5 billion before, we kind of were eking up, it's inflation, it's natural. But if it went from 6 to 10, then it's exponential. And that's why this matters so much.
Well, yeah, in fact, you can look, there's been roughly almost a Moore's Law of campaign finance where it has increased since the 70s every 4 years by roughly 40%. And that was through till 2008. And then from 2008 to 2012, it almost doubled. And our research showed that it went from $6 billion to $10 billion. And the $6 billion figure that was given immediately after the election looked primarily at just the federal elections, and didn't look at the state and local elections, referenda, judicial elections, which are a huge part of the governance of this country and where there were enormous increases in spending. And so when you look at all that, you're up to $10 billion. Now, dark, and this is important, I mean, just to put this in context, I don't know what Sweden's spending is, or Germany's, or Britain's, but I'm willing to bet on a per capita basis it's 1/50th to 1/100th, maybe 1/1000th of what we spend. They don't, and they have much higher voter turnout. They probably have voters who are better informed. It'd be hard to be opposite that. And they don't spend anywhere near that money. So what are we getting for this money? If we're spending $10 million, we ought to have the best system in the world by the market economics. We should be have the geniuses voting.
Like a medical care system.
Yeah, like right. The most, yeah, right. You got it, Mark. There we are. So what are we getting for this money? Well, you know, clearly we're not getting anything that's helping our election system. God help us if it were. We're getting something that's distracting us. And we're getting money that is increasingly what's called dark money, which is that Citizens United opened the door for the creation of third-party groups, where money, unlimited amounts of money can be given to groups that aren't formally connected to campaigns. And these groups then basically you can give as much as you want. Technically, still, you're restricted in how much you can give to a campaign, although that might change soon. And so these dark money groups, third-party groups, have emerged for billionaires like Adelson and others to donate money. And what they learned is that the enforcement is so lax on these groups, and the laws are written in such a way that it can be anonymous money. That's where the term dark money comes from. And we talk in the book about this sort of Cayman Island money laundering system that has developed that's like a drug dealer. And so billionaires can fund enormous amounts of money. Corporations can that can't be traced, and they can influence elections, and they love to do that. The Shelley Adelsons of the world are the exceptions. The billionaire says, hey, look at me. I'm spending all this money. Ha, ha. Aren't I great? Most of them don't want any attention for understandable reasons. They want to buy the election to get the outcome. And I think when you look at a Shelley Adelson, he's very instructive to understand what's emerging, what sort of society we're in, because I think most people think, I've given money to campaigns, I'm willing to bet most of the people in the room have given money to candidates at one point or another. And most a lot of Americans have, although a distinct minority. But most people, when they give money, say, well, I want to vote support this candidate because I believe in their values, I think they're talented, I think their vision for the country. You don't give a $50 campaign because, hey, I'm going to get a payoff from this. So this is going to produce $100 in my wallet by giving this candidate $50, like some Ponzi scheme. Well, this $10 billion, a decreasing percentage of that is actually represents sort of civic donations by small funders. There's some of that, but that's going to keep shrinking. The overwhelming lion's share of that are people who don't view campaign donations as sort of donations to civic culture to participate as citizens, but they're made as investments, and it's a very different logic. And Shelley Adelson was quite clear in explaining that to us for those of us who aren't quick enough to grasp it. Shelley Adelson said, look, I'm for socialized medicine. I'm for a woman's right to choose. I'm for gay rights and gay marriage. I believe in stem cell research, and I'm concerned about global warming and climate change. So you listen to that part, you think, oh, Shelley Adelson, big supporter of liberals and leftists, right? But Shelley Adelson said, but I'm investing in candidates because I don't want labor unions, I hate labor unions, and I don't want to pay taxes, and I don't want the government prosecuting me for some gray area stuff I'm doing in Asia. So I'm going to spend $150 million to get some politicians who are going to help me inflate my bottom line. It's an investment for me. He's just blunt about it. And it's nothing to do with civic virtue. If he's donating money in civic virtue, what he believes in, he'd be giving money to a whole different set of candidates. Well, that's what's rational for these people. You're making investments. You know, I was in Norway recently, and I was talking to a conservative politician. And the conservatives just won the Norwegian election. He's happy about that. And I was explaining, he asked me, what's your book about? And I explained it to him. And he heard about the system, and he said, that's corruption. Like, how could you have that? That's so obviously corruption. I mean, to him, even, Norway, he thinks conservatives don't need to buy elections to win them. They can win an election. Yeah, they can win on their ideas, for better or for worse. And in this country, as Shelley Adelson makes clear, we've created a system in which purchasing elections, dominating them, can be done in an absence of journalism. A complete absence of journalism, there's very little information competing that people have that they can draw from to get alternative discussions of candidates, of ideas, of issues. And that's the boat we're swimming in or sinking in right now.
So folks, start coming up to the mic. Let's spend the last half an hour with everybody kind of bringing their ideas to the fray here. And as they come up there, John, I mean, you end this book in a very optimistic note in terms of where we have to go. But let me push back a little bit on the optimistic note you ended on and see it and how you respond. I mean, that we have this new, whether it's the new ruling that could come into play in, as you talked about in your, and the article you two just wrote the other day, that would end the limit on campaign contributions from anybody, right?
Yeah.
You've got this huge corporate-dominated media. When movements have changed things in America, there have been unions, progressive parties, organizations, civil rights movement. There's a movement to end segregation. So people pushed. Most people in America feel disenfranchised already, which is why they don't vote. So talk about how you see a movement developing to confront it.
All right. Well, as brilliant as I think you are, you're kind of wrong.
All right, good.
And because the funny thing is, we didn't have those movements until we created the movements to make the radical changes that were so overwhelming and so impossible that you needed to get everybody together to do it. And this is a very important thing to understand. You're right, we have done huge reform in this country. But if it was easy, or frankly, you know, if we had these structural things in place, we probably would have eliminated slavery like in 1788. We didn't get around to it until 1865. And we probably would have treated women equally, you know, 1789. We didn't get around to that till 1920. The fact of the matter is, there weren't structural things in place to make these changes occur. We put them in place because we realized the crisis was so severe that we had to act. Our book, our optimism is rooted in crisis. And what we actually say, we go into great detail on this, we argue that there are such things as critical junctures. There are moments in history where things get so bad that everybody kind of looks around at each other and says, we have to do something about this. And we happen to believe we've reached one. And that is ultimately like the fever that must break before you feel better. It is healthy that we are beginning, that these people, this is a great turnout. We love that we're here in Baltimore, Maryland, and we got all our seats filled, we got a big crowd of folks here, and you realize this is enough people in every town in America. If we have this level of critical mass, people who actually go out and get committed and work at this, we could change this country. There is no doubt of that. And the question is, what do we seek? How do we seek to change it? The argument we make in the book, very simple one, is this. You can't build a movement by saying, I want to tinker around the edges of the problem. You cannot build a movement by saying, yeah, you know, I mean, things are really bad. Maybe we could have some disclosure. You know? Excuse me? Like, disclosure? No. Disclosure is like the entry drug. I want disclosure so I can get to stopping the things that are disclosed. And so what happened 100 years ago, it's a very simple thing we deal with it in the book. 100 years ago, if you looked around this country, you saw a country where little girls, 6, 7 years old, worked in factories. And they were called bobbin girls. They had to change the bobbins on the machines. But they didn't stop the machines always when the little girls changed the bobbins. And the reason they had little girls do it was twofold. Number one, their fingers were tiny, and so they could reach in and do it and change the bobbin, and bigger fingers couldn't do that. But sometimes the machine would cut the little girl's fingers off, chop their hand up. And it was okay because they were little girls, and they were not, you know, your mature workers, right? So you had that 100 years ago. When those girls, if they made it up to be like 18, 19, 20 years old, these immigrants from Russia and from Eastern Europe and from Italy and Jews and Christians and Muslims and others who are coming from around the world to live in this country, if they got of age, they got to work in a garment factory maybe. And sometimes it may be in a city, it was on the 10th or 11th floor of a building. And at the Triangle Shirtwaist Garment Factory, when it caught on fire, they ran to go down the exits, and they found they'd been locked shut so that the women wouldn't take bathroom breaks while they're supposed to be working. This wasn't Bangladesh. This was America 100 years ago, and we didn't have a strong enough labor movement to deal with that. We didn't have the structural stuff in place. People got really furious. And what they recognized is they didn't have small d democratic power to do anything about it because those women couldn't vote. And if they could vote, they couldn't elect their U.S. Senate because we had an appointed U.S. Senate not an elected U.S. Senate. And if they did elect a U.S. Senate, they couldn't do much because we didn't have an Internal Revenue Service or a tax system where we could tax the wealthy, tax corporations, and actually create a government that might be able to do something. And so the changes that they demanded weren't, oh, we want a little bit of tinkering around the edge. They said, no, we are going to give women the right to vote. We're going to have an elected government, not an appointed one, and we're going to have the power to tax the rich. And in 10 years, from 1910 to 1920, they enacted constitutional amendments to do each of those things based on their fury at the circumstance in which they lived. We need to get that furious again and not stop till we get the amendments to solve our problem.
Amen. And that was not a softball question. That was a loaded ball question. So there we are. So the mics.
Hi there. Thanks to both of you for your book. I'm Charlie Cooper. I'm president of Get Money Out Maryland, and we're pretty angry about Citizens United, and we think we need a constitutional amendment to say money isn't speech and corporations aren't persons. We think that the Congress that is corrupted and bought by the ultra-rich and the corporations isn't going to give us an amendment. We're going to our state legislature to issue a call for a constitutional, for a convention to write the amendment. And we're wondering how you see the strategy to get the bunch of constitutional amendments you want.
Great question.
John, go ahead.
No. Quick answer is, if we had a media that covered politics in America, everybody in this room, and frankly everybody in the country, would know that the most vibrant movement in America today is to overturn Citizens United. 16 states have formally petitioned the Congress of the United States to do a constitutional amendment to overturn Citizens United. 500 communities have demanded officially that the Congress of the United States act to say money is not speech, corporations are not people. This is huge. Rarely in our history have we had this level of dynamism. Now, it's not well covered. It's not well discussed. And Maryland is not yet on the list. And I understand that nobody gets excited about anything until Maryland acts. But the fact of the matter is that something real is happening out there. Now, people say to us all the time, and we deal with this in the book, should you do a constitutional convention? Should you do a series of amendments? We've never done a constitutional convention except the founding one in this country. And there are people who get very uncomfortable. They say, oh, you know, folks will come in and you'll get things. You want to say something, Charlie?
Well, I just want to say that our idea with our resolution that's going to be in the Maryland General Assembly, it's not a constitutional convention.
I know.
Under Article 5.
The states
it's a convention to draft an amendment.
Yes.
About citizenship.
And we're with you on it. And the fact of the matter is that there are, what I'm saying is people have lots of different answers. They're proposing many different approaches to do this. And what we say in the book is, that's great. You know what? When we get to critical mass, do you know how many different amendments there were to give women the right to vote? There were stacks of them. Some of them even had things like the ERA in them. You know, so when we get to critical mass, we can sort out what we do with the country that we have control of. But the critical thing now is to think about how we build these movements. And to our mind, the most important thing is to think of this as a construct, not as an end of the line. And that's why we put the right to vote amendment at the start of this thing. We say, well, there should be a guaranteed right to vote. Absolutely. And there should be something to get money out of politics. And we ought to eliminate the Electoral College, because never again should somebody who lost an election, like George Bush, become president of the United States. And we should eliminate gerrymandering, because if you do all these other changes, and then you still can't have competitive elections. So we're talking about a pile of amendments here. And people say, oh, well, that's way too much. That's too much change. Who would ever think of doing a stack of amendments to address a problem? Except the founders of the American experiment, who 4 years after they wrote the Constitution, because the people wouldn't accept it, came and put in 10 amendments as a Bill of Rights. So the fact of the matter is that's how we ought to think about it. We can refound our republic again and again and again. That's what the best of the founders wanted. We are at a founding moment. We didn't have the internet before. We didn't have this concentration of wealth. There's a lot of things we didn't have before. Let's go back and add the amendments that work. And if it takes three or four of them, that's great. And And let's also recognize that the genius of the people will figure out the language of those amendments, whether it's in a convention, whether it's in a referendum where people draw things. I'm not going to tell you how to do that final step. I'm going to tell you that you need to get everybody committed to the idea that it has to happen.
That was John Nichols. You also heard Robert McChesney. They're the authors of the book Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. We'll be right back to hear more of our conversation with Bob McChesney and John Nichols. Welcome back. Today on the show, we're listening to an interview I recorded earlier this week with John Nichols and Robert McChesney about their book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We recorded the conversation at 2640 in Baltimore this past Tuesday at an event organized by Red Emmas. We recorded it in partnership with the Real News Network, and soon they'll be posting their video of our conversation at therealnews.com. Let's get right back to it with questions from the audience that joined us at 2640.
My name is Dan Greifenberger, and I just want to say I really appreciate your discussion tonight. It's very invigorating, and it's good to hear people be passionate, because that's really where all change comes from. Because if you're not feeling it, you're not going to do it. Simple as that. So what I would like to ask is, to add to your list of things of changes, maybe we need to get rid of the filibuster in the Senate. I was just thinking about all the judges that are not lunatic fringe people that are not being put on the courts because we have a Democrat in office, and here he's almost 5 years into his term, and he can't get his judges through, especially the ones in the Circuit Court of Appeals, the D.C. Circuit, which is second to the Supreme Court. So what I'm asking about here is, if the Senate can't do a simple thing like get rid of the filibuster to get the judges through that are being backlogged by a Democratic president who's been elected twice by a decent margin, I really don't know where we're going to get help, because obviously the Democrats have the one arm tied behind their back. And then we're seeing now the undermining of health care, Obamacare, whatever you want to call it, is something that is being undermined as we speak, and millions of dollars are pouring into this effort. And I just want to understand, who wants people not to have health care? Whose interest is this? Is this just an ideological thing? Like, I'm an Orthodox this, and you're a liberal that, and I just want my team to win? Or is this something, is there a vested interest in keeping people to use the emergency room? I mean, we're talking about 30 million Americans, and all the half the Republican states, the governors won't expand Medicare, which is a freebie. I mean, practically, the federal government's going to underwrite it for the most part. So I'm just trying to understand, you know, if we elect people, like liberal Democrats, and they can't even get the filibuster out of the way and get their own people in the courts, how can we really change anything? These people are wimps we're electing. I mean, you know, how much power do we have if they, with all this power, can't even do anything? So thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think a lot of that was commentary. With regard to the filibuster, I think it's important to understand that's not a constitutional issue. That's not an issue you can blame Mitch McConnell for. The Democrats had the power to get rid of the filibuster, and they elected not to do it. And it's a point we make in the book, and I think it's very important, that the Republicans are the card-carrying champions of dollarocracy. I mean, they proudly are out to advance the wealthy. But the Democrats are more than junior partners. They're very much complicit in this process. You know, in a two-party system, if one party moves radically to the right, it's taken over by business. And the Republicans, as I think this state knows, at one time actually had liberal and moderate wings that were a crucial part of the party, and they were well to the left of many Democrats. But as the Republicans have shed their moderates and even some of their conservatives moved way to the right, the Democrats have followed in their wake, and they're right behind them. So that the whole center of gravity of the political system is to the right, and that the Democrats didn't get rid of the filibuster in 2008, 2010, right, or 2012, says everything you need to know about it's not just that they're wimpy, they don't want to win for a reason, because who funds the Democrats? I mean, there's a tremendous amount of pressure in the Democratic Party to make it conform to the interests of money on issue after issue after issue. They're structurally part of the system. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't great backbencher Democrats. John and I know a lot of them. We work with them. And I can't say they're great backbencher Republicans. On some issues, there are.
There's a Republican sponsoring constitutional
amendment
to overturn citizens.
That's right. So, but at the same point, they're backbenchers. The closer you get to power in the Democratic Party on issue after issue, the closer you get to pretty much a consensus opinion of big money dominating both parties. I say that with no pleasure. It's not something I enjoy. Some people enjoy trashing the Democrats. I don't. But I also have to be honest. That's the truth.
Let me just, before we take this wonderful question, let me just one final element on that. When you come to hear us and you read our book, you won't see it in the book because I think we explain it pretty well, but you might think that we just want to have a constitutional amendment on everything, that we think the only way to fix anything is a pile of constitutional amendments. That's actually not the case. We are very committed to the idea of amending the Constitution where it is necessary structurally to make possible democracy. That's the point of it. It isn't to, you know, lock things in and then not let there be a great debate. And so to our view, many of the issues this gentleman brings up, that you require a constitutional amendment to get to the point where then you can begin to do these things, but you have to have it to get there. And the classic case answer to this question is, do you want to know how to get rid of the filibuster? You get rid of gerrymandering, right? You get, and now filibuster is obviously Senate, which is not a gerrymandered institution, but you know the idea that if in politics you can be punished for being obstructionist, right? That your district is competitive and you don't do a good job, you come home, you're going to lose your election. That's going to fundamentally change the whole of Congress right there. Now, that's a structural change that then allows for the debate to become real. That's what we think is vital. And what we're saying is we have become a dollarocracy. In a dollarocracy, it doesn't work. The structure now allows the people who want gridlock to win. And understand this, this is so important. If you are living in a country where we've had the most massive redistribution of the wealth upward in the history of the world, and we have a huge income gap that's growing bigger and bigger all the time, and you're on the winning side of that, do you really have a problem with gridlock? I mean, no. You don't want anything to change. You don't want great debates. You want it to stay just how it is. But those of us who don't like that, we would like a change.
Thanks for stopping in Baltimore on your tour. I just wanted you to assess the role of the New York Times these days in the media.
Well, I'll say real quickly, one of the ironies of the fact that news media has collapsed, journalism is no longer done. We have in most cities, and I think Baltimore is no exception, maybe compared to 25 years ago, there may be 40% of the number of working reporters, paid reporters in any medium, digital or non-digital, than there were back then. And we've seen just a collapse of journalism, which is disguised to a lot of people because there's still what's called news. You still have websites, you still have cable channels. But as we know, much of the content is really just public relations spin. It's press releases. It's stuff that's planted. It's not really journalism with reporting and digging and fact-checking. And so what's happened is that most newspapers, like the Baltimore Sun is a classic example, have closed all their foreign bureaus.
Right.
We have very little foreign coverage. The Sun used to be a great newspaper for foreign coverage for a city this size. I mean, that was true of a number of papers in this country. And so what that means is, ironically, the New York Times is shrinking too, but it's sort of the last fighter standing. So it has a much larger role in our culture today than it did 25 years ago, because they're the only ones who have reporters in a lot of areas now around the world. And it's sort of an irony that it plays that large of a role. And I'll let John tee off on that too.
Just a quick thing on it. The most fascinating thing about the Bush era was that the New York Times emerged as an opposition newspaper. It's true. Like the Times or hate it, the fact is that it was pretty clear the New York Times editorially and frankly a lot of, had a problem with George Bush. And that came through. And so a lot of people, I think, started to think, well, you know, the New York Times is pretty useful. You know, it kind of liken what it does. We forgot about Judith Miller and the Iraq War, but, you know, by and large, you know, seeing some things that are good. It's interesting now that there's a Democratic president, and now, you know, the role that the Times plays is quite fascinating. And I think this is the role, frankly, that an awfully lot of our media plays today. And that is, it polices the process to make sure nobody gets too interesting. Because I know it seems anti-journalistic, but the fact of the matter is, I covered a lot of the New York mayoral race. I looked a lot at the New York mayoral race. And you have this guy, Bill de Blasio, who is, you know, I mean, he's a little to the right of FDR, but he's a, you know, relatively progressive guy, and he's running for mayor of New York. And the New York Times editorial opposing Bill de Blasio and backing Christine Quinn said, look, de Blasio's got the big ideas. He's got a lot of proposals. He's really talking about two cities and addressing income inequality, taxing the rich, giving money to poor kids, doing some pretty exciting things. He really wants to do stuff. And so don't vote for him because he's interesting. And no, I'm serious. You read the editorial. It's an astounding statement. It says don't vote for him because he's very, very interesting. He's got all these big ideas. And, you know, it's just never going to happen. You can't fix things or do stuff like that. Vote for Christine Quinn because she really proposes little stuff that isn't all that interesting. And the incredible thing is, and I'm not making this up, the Times ran that editorial big on Sunday, a couple weeks before the election. And it was that literally within days, the polling showed a major uptick for de Blasio. And I would argue that there really were a lot of people who read that and said, you know what, I'm going to gamble one more time on the big stuff, you know, like wealth and poverty. And so I really think this is, I'd say it joking, but it's a serious reality. I think that I like the Times. I read it all the time. I find it useful. And I really value it. And I love that. The home section, the food stuff, it's wonderful. But, you know, I would just say a little measure of caution there because unlike what you think journalism should be, I think today most of American journalism has its ambition to keep things as boring as humanly possible.
That's right.
And to tell us that our choices are narrow rather than wide. And Bob and I write about this in one of our other books. We talk about when Howard Dean came along. And Howard Dean was pretty interesting. And so what they said was, initially the reports on him was, he's too interesting to be president, right? And then when the American people said, yeah, we like interesting, and they actually started backing the guy, then what did they do on the front of Newsweek and other places? They're like, is he too crazy to be president? And they actually like started to question it. And the only thing you can say is that's a policing role. That's saying, don't dream big, don't look for more options. Think narrow. Keep it safe. Keep it comfortable. And I just don't think that that's what journalism should do. I think journalism ought to introduce us to big, bold ideas and tell us scary things and get us all hyped up, because that's what Tom Paine did in 1775 and 1776. And, heck, we created a country.
Just a bit of Baltimore history. William Lloyd Garrison spent 40 days in a Baltimore City jail for slandering a slave captain of a ship.
And had a great newspaper in the day.
And he had a great newspaper.
That's right.
Yeah. With a postal subsidy.
With a column that allowed slave owners to have a column so they could be attacked.
Nice.
Yes, he did. Anyway, go ahead.
A little bit more history. The Baltimore Peace Movement, October 2002, worked very hard to get Senator Sarbanes, Senator Mikulski, Representative Cardin, Representative Cummings, my congressperson, to vote against going to war with Iraq. Now we come to Syria, and we have Mikulski. Cardin's now a senator. They both cave. My Representative Cummings tells us he's on the fence. And also, we had John Sarbanes is on the fence. So I'm asking for your comments on this situation. Some people are saying this is a transformational moment right now because we managed to prevent this attack on Syria. So I'd be curious to hear what you're thinking about what's going on now. Did the peace movement, for the first time possibly in history, stop this attack?
It's a great question.
John, you've been talking about this and writing about this more than just about anyone I know. You've been covering the peace movement. I would just, let me just add one comment, though. I think it is a victory to some extent for the peace movement, And John will talk about that, and we should be proud of it and happy with it. There's also this sort of odd partisan edge here where Republicans, who normally would be eager to blast stuff out of
something.
People of non-white people in the Middle East, you know, for partisan reasons are going to not fall that way because it's a Democratic president. And I think a lot of the Democratic people who are supporting the war probably, if we're a Republican president, wouldn't be on the fence.
Right, right, sure.
But for us, who are concerned about peace, this should be a matter of principle, not, you know, that's what's here at stake. And what's completely absent on both sides of the aisle is principle, unfortunately, even still. But now I'll let John take it from there.
Well, let me begin by saying that we are in a church. Obviously not in the active, necessarily always church part of the church, but we're in a church. And one of the things that we lose sight of is that when we talk about the peace community, the anti-war community, I came up here. We're coming up from downtown. I went by the big Catholic cathedral, and they had a thing about pray for Syria. And we forget that our religious communities actually are a consistent peace, some of them, not all, pretty consistent peace community that is there. And so we often think of the peace community as just, you know, the committee that was organized. There's a lot out there. There's an infrastructure that does question. It's rarely, if ever, covered as that. I was astounded that the Pope's role in arguing against an attack on Syria was huge. Absolutely. And it was minimally covered. We think Putin was the only guy that did anything. The Pope was on the phone to world leaders. He was writing letters to the G20. He organized an international day of prayer and fasting for Syria. That's very different than the last Pope, so let's just put that in the mix right there. So, you know, we should understand that we don't cover all the stuff that's going on, so our media ill serves us there. But I have to say, at the end, this wasn't the peace movement. I don't think. It wasn't just the peace movement. The peace movement there, it actually holds out alternatives and ideas. What I really think was something kind of even cooler than that. The people. Like, the whole bunch of them. And this is a fascinating thing, because our media says that Americans are war-weary. Americans are tired, right? And it's a fascinating thing. It could not be a more insulting comment, right? That, you know, Americans love a war.
Darn now.
You know, nothing better than a war, but we're tired. Maybe if we get a good night's rest, we could be ready for a big one. You know, or, you know, if we did a little vacation, I'm sure we'd come back ready for a war. But we're weary at the moment. What a horrible concept, right? You know? And I think it's rooted in the way the media looks at the American people. I would argue something different altogether. Americans are war wary. Take a letter out. Take the E out of there. And that means they're skeptical. They're doubtful. Because amazingly enough, as bad as our media is and as bad as our politics is, the American people actually kind of pay attention to things like war and peace. If their kids get sent off to wars through an economic draft, things of that nature. And they've looked at, you know, they're willing to believe their government now and again. And they were told these wars were going to be easy. Dick Cheney, we're going to be greeted as liberators. Right? Didn't happen that way. The wars aren't as easy as we're told. They cost a fortune. We're told we cannot pay for education or food, or we're going to have to cut food stamps because we're broke, but we can pay for wars. And I just think that over the last 15 years, 10 to 15 years, the American people have actually been paying more attention than the media or the political class gave them credit for. And when Barack Obama, a president who they sort of, you know, they just reelected, they kind of like him, he came forward with this idea. He said, oh, you know, I'm a very powerful man. I saw something I didn't like. I want to go and have a war. And give him his due. I think he wanted to do good. You know, he wanted to try and just, you know, the American people said, no, we have been paying a lot of attention to this stuff, and we are quite sure these things don't work. And yet it still would have happened. The war, we'd be bombing Syria right now, except for one fascinating structural reality. In 2002, when you were working so hard, Dick Cheney went to a VFW convention in August, and he said all this stuff about Iraq. And Andrew Card, who was a big power player in the White House, big messaging guy, said, you know, hey, Dick, you know, we don't roll out new product in August, right? You wait till September to do that, right? And you're like, well, what's the difference between August and September? It's a little warmer? And no. No, in September, Congress is off its recess. It's back in Washington. When you're in Washington and the money and media complex is in full churn, it can convince members of Congress that they got to go to war. It can actually convince them that their constituents really like this idea. But when the members are actually home in their districts, and they're going to churches and union halls and coffee shops, and they're encountering people, and everyone says, don't do it, that bubbles up, and it actually had an impact. And I just have to tell you, I think the American people stopped a war. And then we also apparently stopped Larry Summers from becoming head of the Fed. And, you know, my friend Steve Earle, the songwriter, he's got a song that says, you know, I went to the gates of heaven. Dream last night, I went to the gates of heaven. I ran into St. Peter. Peter said, come on in. I said, Pete, I ain't satisfied. And, you know, if we could stop a war and prevent Larry Summers from heading the Fed, I think we should be meeting tonight not to celebrate what we'd have achieved, but to think what our next demand might be. Because I think we have an immense amount more power than our media or our political class would tell us.
Thanks a lot.
Let me just say, we'll get to everybody here. It is 9 o'clock. And you're all still going to sign some books?
No. We'll stay as long as you want.
All right, so we'll these last three questions, and then we'll get to little book signings. All right? All right, cool. Go ahead.
Can I ask, too, because I'm a member of the media. Sorry, I had a cold, and I'm also running for office.
You are the media and the political politician.
Class. I'm the double-edged sword here, so to speak. But
Bonnie, tell them the name of the newspaper.
Oh, I'm getting there. I helped found Word on the Street, the street paper for the homeless here in Baltimore. So we cover poverty and homelessness, and we don't take any advertising whatsoever unless you're doing work for the homeless or the poor, and that's free. So how do you stay in business 5 years down the road when you refuse to do that? Because we will quit and we will walk out. We're all volunteer run. We don't make any money. That's my first question, if you have any strategies or ideas for us. And my second question is, what do you think about the Electoral College and the role it plays in all of this in addition to the constitutional amendments?
Got it. It's in the book.
It's in the book.
Wow. Yeah, well, to run any news media, even if you were desperate for advertising support today and you would sell your soul for it, unfortunately, it's not a very good time. So if you're, and you know, even if you wanted, you wouldn't get much probably because advertising is shifting away. The reason why journalism is dying is that we're entering an era of smart advertising. And that means that the traditional way advertising has supported news media for the past 125 years, which is advertisers would buy an ad in the Baltimore Sun or on broadcast news program, and then they'd pay the Baltimore Sun money to have access to the Sun's readers, and the Sun would keep some of the money to pay for journalists to put content in to draw readers. That was the deal. That's how advertising supported journalism. That's dying. That's ending. Now, as we switch to a digital environment, smart advertising is emerging. That means that instead of buying a website, giving them money so you can then have ads that would go to all the readers of the website or visitors to the website, instead what's happening is that a company would go to Microsoft or AOL or Google, one of the four great ad networks online, and say, we want to buy 20 million American women, 18 to 29, because we're selling such and such a product. That's our market, about 20 million of them. And they'll get them in the next day, and they'll find those 20 million women whatever website they go to. And that's why you'll see crazy ads if you go to crazy websites. They find you. They know everything about you. We know that now. They know where to find you, and they know everything about you. And so the website that carries those ads gets no money at all. The newspapers got 100% of their website advertising revenue in 2003. By 2010, they were down to 20%, and today I'm willing to bet it's under 10 for most newspapers, if not less. It's falling. Advertising's gone. That's why Jeff Bezos buys the Washington Post. He reaches into the spare change drawer for $250 million. That's probably the Washington Post probably would have sold for $5 or $6 billion a decade ago. It's people have given up, and that's why we have to come up with public policy solutions if we want journalism. The market isn't going to solve the problem. So that even if you wanted to be advertising based, it wouldn't work.
Oh, we don't.
I know you don't. I got that. I picked up on that. But so how do you support yourself? Well, your volunteer labor, you're printing a publication, your costs are very low, you don't take advertising. There's the way people do it. You beg for donations. You get people to contribute. That's the only way that's the way these things are done. If you have an organization that's sponsoring you, that you work with, they might be able to raise money to support it. That's how a lot of publications survive. But it's, you know, it's always going to be a struggle in your situation. And I wish there were some sort of secret tip I could tell you how to make the money. There isn't one.
Okay. When we fix the media, we're going to have it's coming
our
your
solutions,
way, sister.
We would take care of you.
And, so can I just offer you this notion?
Okay.
If you're going to work in the media in this country, God bless you. I'm 100% with you. But also be a media reformer, too. You've got to be fighting for the structural changes that sustain media so that you can do it the rest of your life rather than do it until you need to eat.
Right.
And so that in that regard. And so become a structuralist as well as a doer. This is the way we make it happen. And do a great job, and people will, you'll be amazed. There are people who have kept small publications doing noble work alive much longer than billionaires have kept major daily newspapers going. So I'm with you there. On the Electoral College, very, very quickly, it is in the book. We talk about the Electoral College. And you know what? In some sense, I'm big on the right to vote. I'm big on getting money out of politics. I really want to get rid of the Electoral College. And I'll tell you why. It's such a disrespect for the people. It is the only reason the Electoral College exists. They come up with all these other reasons. There's one reason it exists. It was created in case we didn't like what you did. And, you know, and it's sort of like, well, the people just stopped a war. That was a really good idea. Maybe we ought to let them elect presidents. But the fact of the matter is, in our lifetime, I think everybody in this room, we had a guy who lost the presidency of the United States by 540,000 votes. He lost the presidency by the measure of virtually any democracy in the world. And yet, he became president of the United States. He did not become president of the United States because of Catherine Harris or Jeb Bush. He didn't become president of the United States because of the Supreme Court intervention. He became president of the United States because there was an electoral college that said that then you could then game the system in one state that was close and tip enough votes in the electoral college to do this. And so the fact of the matter is, if you don't like George Bush, you should not like the electoral college. And I don't think people would elect George Bush president again. So why don't we go out and fix the thing that made him president in the first place? It's a big passion of ours. And there are bills in Congress to do it. There actually is people talking about it.
Cool. Thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you, Bonnie. That was John Nichols. You also heard Robert McChesney. They're the authors of the book Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We have to take a very brief break, but don't go away. And we'll be right back to hear more of our conversation with Bob McChesney and John Nichols. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and today on the show, we're listening to an interview I recorded with John Nichols and Robert McChesney about their book, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America. We recorded it at 2640 in Baltimore last Tuesday at an event organized by Red Emmas. Let's get right back to it with questions from the audience that joined us at 2640.
Thanks. You guys are great. I can't wait to read your book. I bought two copies tonight. I've always talked about the corptocracy in this country. Now maybe I'll decide that it's the dollarocracy. My question is, aside from the media and money that have created the problems in our political system, what role do you think the educational system and the lack of teaching of anything that even remotely sounds like physics or government or... I have two granddaughters who don't know from nothing about what's going on in this country. They, even in their own state or their own city, they're both in university. They're unfortunately living in Texas. One's at SMU and the other's at TCU. Bright kids. They display an incredible lack of interest in what's going on. And any role that they may ever have to play in what's going on, or even that it would be important. The apathy and the cynicism of lots of kids in this country, young people, who are the products of our public education system, really gives me pause and makes me wonder. And I'd like to hear you comment on that. Because you're very enthusiastic and positive, optimistic, about what we can do. If we can't produce the next generation and the generation after that who have some awareness of our political system and how they can influence it, I can't share your enthusiasm and your optimism. So could you comment, please?
Yeah, I would say, first of all, we shouldn't put that all on the education system. I think we're living in a culture where the implicit message that's handed down from the top is that being interested in politics in the world is a waste of time, that being apolitical is cool. I think that's part of dollarocracy. Because if they convince people not to be interested in politics, not to care about justice, not care about these issues, that's three-quarters of the battle. Mm-hmm. Then they don't have to worry about opposition. It costs them less to keep power. So I think the young people who feel that way are not simply that way because of a bad education system. They're that way because the dominant themes, or the underlying themes is a better way to put it, encourage that as a rational behavior. Now, I would also say that as far as educational systems go, that's one of the core fights of democracy. You're right. I'd put that right in there as equal to election systems, media systems. And the great fight, the great victories in this country in the 20th century prior to the 1970s were efforts to create quality public education for working class people. And it hasn't always worked that way, but there are parts of this country where we actually, New York City being one, where we actually had quite good education for working class people in public schools. And there are other places where that's true as well. And I think the dollarcrats have been taking dead aim at public education for working class people, for middle class people, from day one. They don't like public education. They don't like funding it. And they've been eager to undermine it. And they're getting their way. I mean, my daughters have gone through public education through their schools, and, you know, I see the effects of this compared to what I had growing up in public schools. It has been a sharp drop. I mean, they're taking these moronic tests constantly. They're jumping through all sorts of idiotic hoops. That's on, but I'm not going to put it all on the schools. I mean, it's the schools respond to the politics, the political pressures they have, and they respond to the broader culture. Which I think does not encourage critical inquiry either. It's a struggle. But I will add one other thing as a college professor who teaches people like your daughters all the time. My sense is that not all of them, and your granddaughters, excuse me, may be the exception, but there is a hunger among young people to understand this world and make sense of it. They might be encouraged by the dominant culture, but I'm constantly impressed. And when John and I talked to, like yesterday we were at Fordham in New York and NYU. Today we were at Temple and Penn. We'll be at University of Maryland and George Washington and American in the next 2 days. We're struck by how many young people desperately want to live in a good society, want to understand it and want to change it. And they feel, you know, frustration that there's no way for them to express that. And there's not institutions that are welcoming of that perspective. And that's our struggle. That's our struggle to create that, to tap into that extraordinary energy. There's just waiting to have the fuse lit.
We're getting late, and I don't want to go forever, but just quickly to say that 40 years ago, when I was a kid, in Madison, Wisconsin, a guy named Edward Ben Elson, Eddie Elson ran. He was kind of a agent provocateur. He's like a yippie guy. He ran for state superintendent of public instruction in Wisconsin. And he ran a joke campaign. And his joke was that we should replace public schools and have vouchers. And we should give parents vouchers and they can send their kid to the school they want. And it was a comedy act. It was a joke. Because you could, you know, nobody would think that. And Eddie got a couple thousand votes from people who were, you know, having fun. And he didn't win. Today, Edward Ben Elson, Eddie Elson, would be in the mainstream of our political discourse with his joke. And this is what we mean by zombie ideas. I mean, the fact that our debate about education is about how to take money away from the public schools and, you know, spread it around in ways that you could never get that critical mass, right, to have the education you want, is a total function of dollarocracy. And again, as I said, this is like I'm on one note here. If you care about these issues, you better fix the dollarocracy because you're not going to fix the other one until that.
We saw, you know, in Wisconsin, you know who the number, when they tried to, there was an attempt to recall Scott Walker as governor. Biggest funding by far. Hugest, you know, critical mass of funding. People who wanted to privatize and voucherize education. There were people in Texas and Arkansas flooding money into Wisconsin and $500,000 donations because they didn't want to lose the guy who was in favor of this. So this is a big deal. But the flip side, and the really cool thing, keep that in mind, be a performer. This is the flip side. It's really cool. Survey research studies what young people think about stuff, you know, as well as older folks. And they found a fascinating thing. Young people are more in favor of socialism now than at any time in history. Now, why? No. It's not because of the radical teachers or anything like that. No. It is. I honestly believe this. They saw Sarah Palin and Rush Limbaugh and all these guys say, I'm against socialism. And they thought, I don't know anything about it. I haven't been taught about it. But you know what? If it's not what they want, I find it rather interesting. And survey research shows today that people under 30 rank socialism even with capitalism as an alternative.
And just one final thing, even though I didn't write the book, like, this is important. I think that I talk to a lot of young people all the time and I have them on my show all the time, young activists from across the community, black, white, Latino. There are a lot of young people out here. They are leading the movement. They are creating their own movements.
Yes.
I mean, they give me a lot of hope because I see what they're doing out here. And they're leading the way. I mean, that's what people in their 20s and 30s do.
You know, that's such a great point, Mark. I think we forget that. Social change is always a young person's game.
It is.
It's always.
Because it's risky.
Young by young people.
Right. It's risky.
Right.
Yeah, and it will be, if we have it again, that's who will be leading it. There's no question about that.
And as long as we're like popcorning back and forth here, as we so often do, let me tell you this. Last night, we were at Judson Memorial Church in New York City with Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. And if you're not familiar with FAIR and their publication Extra, you should be. They're incredible media critics. They did the coolest thing. They had Jeremy Scahill spoke. It was a wonderful event to debut the book, but our friend Jeremy Scahill spoke. Our friend Amy Goodman came and spoke. Bob and I spoke. They had a young, like under 30, I think, I hope I'm estimating it right, journalist introduce each of us to show that there is a new generation of people who are, you know, literally scratching their way into this business, this incredibly hard thing to do, and creating great labor, community, social journalism. And you know what was the embarrassing thing? I know each of these people. Many of them write for The Nation and stuff like that, and they were all better than I was at that age. In fact, a couple of them are better than I am now. And so the bottom line is there are young people coming up, but one of the most horrible things we do to them is make it really hard. And so if we're they're there. Some of them are actually fighting their way in, but imagine what would happen if we made it possible, if we made it easier for young people to really be a part of this thing. And that's why we propose in one of our books, we talk about in this book, the idea that, we have AmeriCorps. We ought to have AmeriCorps for journalism. We ought to give young people stipends to go into undercover neighborhoods and go and report and do that. And because think of what could happen if you had 5 AmeriCorps journalists in the poorest neighborhood in a town using social media. And you didn't have to pay him much, but what could we do? And our idea was to combine that AmeriCorps for journalism with Peace Corps for journalism. And so we'd take kids and put them into inner city and immigrant neighborhoods. You'd spend a year reporting on your neighborhood, get to know people, get to know the ethnic communities, and then we'd send you to the country that folks from that neighborhood lived in, and you could report back to where you'd been a reporter about some country overseas. And after those 2 years, if that person isn't ready to take off as a journalist, I don't know who would. And that would cost us, compared to a war or a missile, nothing. That's the way we have to think. That's what we have to start talking about.
Hi, thank you for the talk. One of my most frustrating things, especially about the media, is the fact that you really have to work at coming up with the truth. Oftentimes, it'll take me like a week or 2 weeks to come, to evaluate an issue and then finally make up my mind. And there's almost nobody that you can rely on. I grew up reading 8 or 10 newspapers. But, it was easy to trust somebody on certain issues. Unfortunately, we don't live in that kind of a time. And it's frustrating. I have to kind of remind myself all the time that it's worth it because, you're spending way too much time as a citizen trying to get at the truth. And, you know, I think people like Democracy Now!, et cetera, they all do a great job, but every once in a while, even they will slip up. I remember, for example, on Democracy Now!, I don't think they got Libya right initially. You know, so I'm not blaming them for it, but the point is that it takes a long time. And I have to keep constantly reminding myself that the reason you need to have the truth, the real information, is because if you don't make up your own mind based on facts that you know, then it's kind of like what you were talking about, the Martin Luther King quote that was there. Then somebody else governs what you are voting for, or, you know, what you're pushing. Do you know, am I making any sense on that? So that's one part of it. The other part of it is, having done all this evaluation for myself, I am extremely skeptical. And here's why I say this. I think that for the people that own this country, and I actually don't want to use any other term but the fact that there are owners of this nation, for them, the game today is not about the United States. This is a done deal. For them, this is a global game. If you look at the papers that are coming out of the Trans-Pacific deal, which is coming up, they want to change the total global scale. They want to have an ability where other countries, sovereign governments, cannot sue them. Right. They have the right to sue the sovereign government, but it's not vice versa. So I think for them, it's a, you know, America is a done deal. And I will tell you why I say this. If you remember the Iraq and the Sextant virus that was, remember? I think if you think about it, if a people have the ability to send a virus into Iraq, what makes us think that they cannot control a voting machine? So, you know, we can have all the amendments, and we can have everything that we want to do, and at some point, all they have to do is really flip a switch. I mean, I'm sorry to sound so skeptical.
So
can you summarize what
it's I mean, it's going back to a little bit of what I said at the end of our conversation, but this takes it globally, which is the question of why do we think that we can have a sense of this, because corporate power is international corporate power. It's not just American corporate power.
Let me take a stab at
way
that.
Beyond
I mean, I think there are so many good points there. The globalization part of it is an excellent point. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, which you talk about, is exactly the sort of dollarocracy issue that we refer to in the book, meaning it's an issue that greatly benefits wealth and privilege, and the more people know about it, they don't like it. And so this is an issue they're trying to keep the public from knowing about. Correct. This is where they don't want anything close to democracy.
That's why they have the secrecy amendments attached to it.
That's right, and they learned that lesson the hard way.
Right.
And John talked about that earlier. Now, I would say, though, while they've basically given up in this country, per se. They don't really care about this country or the people in it. And I think that when you move all your jobs and you trash the environment, that's evident of that. But at the same time, I would say they might have given up in this country. They haven't given up on the country government. The U.S. government is they wanted to use it as their primary weapon to craft this world, to be
Absolutely.
The military, to set up the rules, to enforce them, to bail them out.
They need
it, and it plays an enormous role. And so even though they might not be interested in the country, they're very interested in controlling this particular government. It's central to the whole process, which just doubles the importance of our fight for that government.
The ability to make war.
Pardon? That's a big part
of it. Right.
But it's not all. The ability to bail out companies once they tank, like in financial crises, the ability to set and enforce the rules. I mean, these deals like Trans-Pacific Partnership require governments to enforce them. And the U.S. government has adopted the role internationally of being their representative, as being their advocate, of being their army, so to speak. And our job is to have the U.S. government be our representative, not only domestically, but internationally. And that's the struggle that's in front of us. And it will be a difficult struggle, but it is the only one we've got to play with. It's the one we've got to do.
I think Bob said it.
Do you want to have a stab at the fact
it's almost 9:30. I think we need to kind of...
I think we got one more question. Thank you, though.
I actually want to kind of respond to the previous commenter and kind of give you a slight critique. The challenge in the work, although I appreciate it, is the challenge of scale, right? So if you imagine that the forces arrayed against us are so daunting that it requires a national movement, mm-hmm. then it becomes very difficult cognitively for people to think about the possibility of local action, and it makes it more likely for kind of ideas that, oh my God, they own the country to take hold, mm-hmm. and that has a radical patina. That is, it sounds radical, but it actually leads, it demobilizes populations, yep. right? So if you think about the thing I go back to, I'm a Detroit guy, I go back to the unions, I'm a black guy, I go back to the civil rights movement. What you have in both of those instances are people organizing in local spaces around local issues, and then those local organizing attempts are connected and then bubbled up, and then they become something national, right?
That's so right.
So it was really more of a comment than.
But no, I want to just you nailed it. And I just want to. It's actually Bob and I've been joking about or been talking about this is the idea of writing you're always thinking about the next thing you're going to write. And one of the things I've been talking about the idea of writing a book about something that I refer to as micro parties, micro political parties, and the argument that the left always tries to create a third party and then it realizes it can't do it and so it ends up defaulting back into the Democratic Party. And frankly, some of the right has the same frustration with the Republican Party. But at the local level, where we can know one another, we can actually form alternative politics. It is not, we should not fail to note that one of the smallest states in the United States, a state where you can actually meet your elected officials, you can meet your neighbors, you get to know them, people actually call everybody by the first name up there, Vermont, is the only state that sent a Democratic Socialist to the United States Senate. And so, with Bernie Sanders. And he serves as an independent, not a Democrat or a Republican. Usually caucuses with the Ds, but is very, very blunt about his frustration there. And so, I think what this gentleman's offering us, and it relates to this, it's a fascinating interplay here of a wonderful question about global challenges. And how do we challenge this huge global thing? Well, the fact of the matter is that I do believe micro parties, this on the ground coming in our place. If you could organize Baltimore for democracy, for something really fundamental, and you make it politically unviable to operate in Baltimore unless you're on the side of the angels, if I can get Cleveland to do the same thing and then get Milwaukee, pretty soon I've got something real. And you know who did that? This is a very interesting thing. When I talked about that age of reform, 1910 to 1920, we could go into this for hours. I'm not going to do it. But the fact of the matter is that you go back and you look at the history of that, you had a progressive mayor here. You had a socialist congressman from the Lower East Side of New York. You had a socialist congressman from Milwaukee. You had Tom Johnson in Cleveland. You had, all these islands around the country of increasingly militant demands. And as you began to weave them together in the midst of a economic downturn, the Great Depression, New Deal didn't just come out of whole cloth. It came out of the fact that you actually had this infrastructure there. And so I'm with you. And I just, the only problem is, you thought you were throwing a problem my way, brother. I'm throwing it right back on you. Because I'm not making this up. I was sending a tweet out while I was listening to all this. And I was saying, I am convinced from hearing the questions and the answers in this room that Baltimore could solve all the problems of America.
So I want to thank Bob McChesney and John Nichols and for being here, coming to Baltimore, spending all this time, a couple hours here.
And Mark Steiner.
And Mark Steiner.
Good to have you all here. And if you haven't bought a book, buy it now before they
make fine holiday gifts.
Thank you for coming.
You've been listening to a conversation between John Nichols and Robert McChesney. John Nichols is the Washington correspondent for Nation magazine and contributing writer for The Progressive and In These Times. He's also the associate editor of The Capital Times, the daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin. Robert McChesney is a professor of communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign and author of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. McChesney and Nichols are the co-authors of the book we've been talking about, Dollarocracy, How the Money and Media Election Complex is Destroying America.